communicating with the body, not the voice today, in the body sphere. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith. As an alternative to speaking, how precisely can you express yourself with gestures, your face, your body language? Conducting a symphony orchestra, for example, how do you indicate the sound you want?
Every piece has a climax, and if you don't keep your biggest gesture for the climax, there won't be one. And a lot of conductors thrash around crying wolf, and then they really want something. They've nothing left except possibly leaving the ground.
Before we meet that conductor, though, let's head to the quietest classroom that I've ever been in anyway, and a group of adults learning Auslan, sign language used by and with deaf people.
1947, 2005.
These people can all hear, so why are they learning Auslan?
My name's Samantha, and I'm learning Auslan because I've been seeing a deaf guy, and I wanted to be able to communicate with him better. It's interesting to me because every time I learn something, it reminds me of this guy, and I go, ah, that makes sense, that's what he means, and I see him do that all the time, or I watch him when he talks to his deaf friends, and it's fun. I teach my best mate everything I've learnt so that we can have our own little secret language.
Well, I was always told that I'd never be very good at playing poker because I can't really hold a poker face very well. My face does give away a lot, sometimes to my detriment, but in this case I think it's an advantage.
So how long do you think it will take you to become fluent in Auslan?
I think it's just practice. And if you have someone to practice it with as well.
Which you do.
Yes. It's exciting when I can go home and, you know, I know how to say dog. Now I just want to go tell him that I know how to say dog.
So far now, because I think we're just learning the basic words. The grammar, I guess, is different, but learning the signs for me is okay. Because I just realised it's kind of like dancing because it's movement with the body, and so it's easier for me to remember.
Because you're a dancer or you're interested in dancing?
I'm a dancer. So it's like kind of choreography, but you're signing.
In the future, where I'm looking to use that language, I can go into the hospital and speak to the little children to do a voluntary job for children. I speak three languages, so I think that will be the fourth language, so why not?
I read The Brain That Changes Itself. It talks about how you can keep your brain young, and they say to learn a language and learn to dance. So I actually think Auslan in a way combines the two because you need to be coordinated, plus it's a very rich language as I'm learning.
So you don't have any definitive plan of what you would do knowing how to communicate through Auslan?
No, it's more out of the pleasure of learning a language. My young son thinks that I'm planning on going to a place called Auslan and will be wanting to talk to the people there.
Do you find now in your normal speech, when you're speaking, you know, with your voice, that you're a lot more gestural anyway with your hands and your face?
Oh my God. Yes, so many of my friends have said everything you say, you do with your hands because you just get used to having to sign everything or symbolise everything.
None of those students are learning sign language to become a professional interpreter, although the job can take you places.
This is Catherine, by the way. Catherine will be signing the entire show tonight. How many of you have seen a sign interpreted show before? Okay, a few of you. If you ever see a deaf performer on stage, which, by the way, Catherine is not, but you would be surprised how many people have asked me the question. I've honestly hung up the phone from her and people have gone, "Who's that?" "Oh, my sign interpreter." "Oh, can she hear?" Yeah, that's kind of the point. You may find yourself laughing maybe twice at various jokes tonight. There may be one laugh at me and then another as you look at her and go, "Oh, is that how you sign wanker?"
Adam Hills, performing in London with British Sign Language interpreter Catherine King, making her well and truly part of the show for the hearing and deaf audience. Julie Judd is a professional Auslan interpreter in Melbourne.
I grew up in a family of
deaf parents, and so signing was my first language, or one of my first languages. I had access to English because I could hear.
So did your parents teach you sign language?
Well, my mum was a stay-at-home mum, and my dad would go off to work. And, of course, to communicate with my mum, the only way to do that was to sign. So she signed to me and I must have learnt to sign back. And I learnt to speak later than a lot of other kids.
So as I understand it, Auslan has its own vocabulary and grammar. It's not just a sort of manual physical representation of spoken English?
That's correct. It doesn't follow English word order. It follows an order in which you use your sight. It's just very different to the way English is sequential.
How do you identify tense?
There are tense markers. So we would have signs such as finish. So you would put the sign finish before what you're going to say, and therefore you would know that it was past tense. Or you might use the sign will, which means future tense. I will do something. So you already know the tense is future because of the signs.
Well, how subtle or complex is it possible to be with a sign language, with Auslan? You know, spoken English has so many possibilities, doesn't it, as far as, you know, its grammar, but also vocab, so many words that have similar but slightly different meanings. What level of subtlety and complexity can you convey with a sign language?
Often I think that you can get more subtlety and complexity with a sign language than you can with English, because we use words to express ideas in English, whereas body language and facial expression and the speed in which you sign something can actually convey such depth. I enjoy using sign language to convey ideas because I think it is subtle but direct. You're not hiding behind words.
What is it like interpreting for comedy? Because I imagine that could be pretty difficult.
It is extremely difficult. I mean, puns, play on words, are the things that get me, and some are not always funny.
Well, that's right, but that's not your job to make them funny or not, I guess.
But I mean in sign language. They're not funny in sign language, even though in English they're hilarious. In Auslan, they just
lose it in translation.
Exactly.
So tell me, what's the hardest thing about being a sign language interpreter?
There's lots of demands in the job, and each job is different. So if you're working, say, on national television for something as important as a fire announcement or an emergency announcement, you've got the pressure of knowing that everybody's looking at you, it's live, you might make a mistake. How are you going to deal with that? So that's in that particular scenario. In other scenarios, if you're interpreting for somebody who's been told that they've got cancer, that affects you. I think learning to work through each of those challenges in a way that's respectful to other people whilst doing your job of conveying information.
Given that you are using sign language a lot, that it is your job, do you find it difficult not to sign when you're with hearing people?
If I'm tired, I'll sometimes sign instead of speak to members of my family, although my father lives with me, so we sign to him anyway, but I will sign to other members of the family who don't sign, which is a little funny and they laugh at me. So I think it comes down to being tired and knowing what language I'm supposed to be using at that time.
Auslan interpreter Julie Judd. On RN, you're listening to The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith. Well, from the perspective of a deaf person, what makes a good interpreter? I haven't ever interviewed a deaf person before, but I'm about to, with the help of an interpreter, of course.
My name is Paul Houston. I'm an Auslan English interpreter.
And today you're interpreting for Janelle. Can you introduce Janelle?
Hello, Amanda. My name is Janelle Whalen. I'm the Auslan coordinator here at VicDeaf.
Janelle, is Auslan your first language?
Yes, it is, Amanda. I was born profoundly deaf, and at 6 months of age, I started to learn Auslan, a few basic signs, and in time, I think around the age of two, I was told, I had a vocabulary of 100 signs.
Whoa. Would you say that deaf people tend to have more expressive hands, eyes, face than hearing people?
I think there's a high percentage of deaf people that are more visually aware. I know myself growing up as a young deaf person, ordinarily hearing people would look away when they were talking to other people, look around, look at the ceiling, look at the ground. For me, it takes some time to get used to talking to hearing people that can look in different directions rather than to the speaker. So for people who communicate in Auslan, whether they be deaf or hearing, they have to maintain eye contact the whole time. So we're very conscious of eye contact and subtleties regarding our faces, facial expression and hands and sign language.
So for you, what makes a good interpreter? Is Paul doing a good job?
Well, I want interpreters who can faithfully convey the message. If I tell you a joke, I want to know that it's been interpreted well, and I want to see the desired result from you, that is some type of recognition, whether it be a smile or a laugh or a chuckle. Some interpreters do that very well, others less so. But most interpreters I've worked with are very good. They have done a lot of training, they're committed, and they're skilled professionals.
So, Paul?
Paul's a fantastic interpreter.
Are you just saying that, Paul?
No, I'm not just saying that. I'm interpreting faithfully what Janelle has just said. Thank you, Amanda.
Now, I have to ask you about that sign language interpreter at Nelson Mandela's memorial service late last year. I guess I never imagined the possibility of someone faking it in public.
You're right. That negative publicity, I think, in the end, turned out to be a positive good news story. In Australia, people heard about this fake interpreter at Nelson Mandela's memorial service and they thought, is that for real? That's unbelievable. So that in itself generated a lot of publicity. It's also led to an increase in the number of Auslan enrolments. And also people are saying, how could you be an interpreter without having that training? And I have read now that in South Africa, the South African Sign Language courses are filling up.
And your Auslan classes here, you've got more people in it as a result of that episode.
Yeah, that's right. It's created an interest and put the spotlight onto sign languages. Many people don't realise, for example, Amanda, that each country has its own national sign language. There's not one sign language for all the different deaf communities of the world. So in Australia, we have Australian Sign Language. In the UK, they have British Sign Language. And in South Africa, they have South African Sign Language and so on.
So, Janelle, do people who are fluent in a particular sign language, in your case Auslan, play with it, you know, make up jargon and new ways of signing? You know, the way that words are constantly invented in English, are people creative with Auslan in that way?
I remember when I was a little girl in primary school, sometimes we, deaf children, would make up signs ourselves. So we would play with Auslan. We would create our own words, use particular facial expressions. You could say, for example, the sign for I fell over. Well, then I may play with that and say, no, I fell over this way and add a lot more facial expression to it. So basically, I would say, you know, I fell over and tripped and went around the world on this trip.
That's fantastic. Janelle, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure. Likewise, Amanda. Lovely to meet you and thank you for the opportunity.
And also thanks to you, Paul.
My pleasure. Thank you, Amanda and Janelle.
Paul Houston, interpreting for Janelle Whalen, who's the Auslan coordinator at VicDef, the Victorian Deaf Society. And if you have any interest in learning Auslan, maybe inspired by that wayward interpreter at Nelson Mandela's memorial, or just to learn another language or for any other reason, there's a link on the Bodysphere website for classes around Australia. Let's turn now, though, to the job where you sign and gesture in order to produce sound from others. Christopher Seaman has had a long and distinguished career as a conductor all around the world, and he's the author of a book called Inside Conducting. He believes there's a strong physical connection between a conductor's movements and the sound of the orchestra.
The conductor's job is to present the orchestra with a picture that shows them how he would like the music played. I remember I was with a young conductor and we were talking to an orchestral player. And I said to this orchestral player, what do you hope for from conductors? And he said, I would like to know how to play by looking at you, not by listening to your lectures. You see?
Yeah.
So the more you can show with your hands, face, eyes, the better.
So how do you communicate your musical ideas and intentions, you know, how what you want the orchestra to play through your body?
For example, an upbeat. An upbeat is like saying and. Now, the character of the upbeat shows the orchestra how to play the note that's coming. So if your upbeat goes and, you will tend to get a smooth attack from the orchestra. If your upbeat goes and, like a sharp, almost Sergeant Majorish, snappy sound, and you will get a different kind of attack from an orchestra. So the orchestra reads you. Another thing that happens is the character of your gestures. If you conduct as if you're stroking a large cat, you will tend to get very smooth playing from an orchestra. If you conduct as if you've got an enormous hatchet and you're trying to chop a tree up into logs, you will get more attack, a slightly harder sound, which is right in some music, and a generally more aggressive attacking effect.
Well, there's a fantastic image you give, a description of a conductor who looked as if he'd devoured the whole score like a huge steak, which was then exuding from the ends of his fingers.
Yeah, that was Victor the Saboteur.
Okay,
oh,
is
yes.
That good?
Oh, yes. You see, you absorb the music. It gets into your bloodstream. It gets into your heart. And then you put it across. So what we're talking about is how you put it across to the orchestra. Now, Saboteur was quite extraordinary, and you always knew what he wanted by looking at him, and it wasn't all that thrashy. It was very concentrated because, you see, if we make our gestures concentrated, the orchestra come to us. And it's much better that they come to us than that we throw everything at them quite indiscriminately.
Is having a baton necessary, Christopher? Why not just use your hands? You know, they're surely more expressive than a stick.
But it depends how you use the baton. And you've still got your left hand, of course, without a baton in it. But if I were in the front of the strings, the first stand of violins, violas, cellos, whatever, I wouldn't mind. But if I was sitting at the back, I think, and I sat at the back of the London Philharmonic for 4 years, I was the timpanist, I think I preferred, there's a certain clarity that comes from a stick, but that it's only a matter of opinion. There are some excellent really fantastic conductors who do not use one. It's just a matter of personal preference. But one thing about a baton is you can use the tip of it to pull a beautiful line out of the orchestra. And when I'm teaching...
You make it sound like a magic wand.
Well, when I'm teaching, I sometimes say to students, imagine you're painting a sticky wall with a long paintbrush. You can pull the most marvellous sound out of an orchestra quite effortlessly.
So, okay, the baton is in your right hand. What are you doing with your left hand?
Well, when you have nothing to say with it, keep it out of the way. Park it somewhere. If stuff's too loud, you hold your left hand up with the palm upwards, like saying to a dog, stay. And the strings understand immediately that they have to use less bow. I knew a violinist who played for the great British, well, actually he was a Northern Irish, he was an Ulsterman, Sir Hamilton Harty. And this man told me, when Harty did that with your left hand, you could not use your bow. You just couldn't. It wouldn't move. So you can have quite a lot of effect on the way the orchestra play. And the other thing that comes out of this is that the effect is partly unconscious. And I was an orchestral player, and the best conductors would always change the way I played, but I never quite knew how. Mm. And the messages, the body language is very subtle, and it's picked up very subtly.
Have you, though, ever been misinterpreted by an orchestra? Can you give out the wrong signals? Something lost
in
translation?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I mean, when I started out conducting, I thought people could play pianissimo if I was thrashing around with enormous gestures. Well, I soon found out that That wouldn't happen. It's physically impossible to play quietly when a conductor's thrashing about. And I have tried over the time I've been a conductor to match what I do with the sound I have in my mind. And this is a lifetime's work because we've all got different bodies. We all move differently.
I was interested, again, to read in your book that Wagner was misunderstood by players in London because his conducting style was so unfamiliar to them.
He did the smoke and mirrors, you know.
All expression,
passes.
No beat.
Yes, but in London, people were not accustomed to that style. They were accustomed to a really clear beat. And the piece he conducted in London that fell apart, or nearly fell apart, was the prelude to Tristan and Isolde, which is wonderful, of course. It's in a slow six in a bar, and the beginning is all rests and pauses. Now imagine that you've never heard the piece in your life. It was very modern sounding anyway, and Wagner does a magic pass. Well, does that mean me? Does that mean somebody else? Is it the first beat? Is it the second beat? Am I supposed to play? And so on. And they just could not get it until his assistant, a guy called Hans Richter, leapt up, stood behind Wagner, and smashed out a clear six in a bar so that the people knew where to play. The audience apparently applauded, and Richter got up and saved the show.
So have you had to say, I mean, what can you do, what do you do when an orchestra is about to go off the rails and crash?
Well, you can normally smell it coming. It normally starts when one part of the orchestra gets out, and if you're really quick, you can fix that almost before they know you've fixed it.
What do you do?
Well, you just make a clear gesture where people are supposed to play. And if a section is starting to get ahead, you look at them, you give a crystal clear beat like a bandmaster in a way they can't resist. But it is a very flexible thing. You're handling, when you conduct, something fluid, not something solid. So there is an ebb and flow all the time.
Are there fashions in conducting as to, you know, degrees of flamboyance with gestures, with beating time and so on?
Yes, there are. I remember as a little boy, first time we bought a television, I must have been about 10 or something, and there'd be orchestral concerts on television. And if a conductor didn't jump around and get into a sweat, I felt I hadn't had any entertainment. I was really disappointed. That conductor's no good. He hardly does anything. Well, of course, that's a 10-year-old who doesn't understand. But unfortunately, a lot of people who are much older than 10 still think that. Conducting was considered to be for the orchestra, not for the audience, generally speaking, until television and film came along. All the old conductors, Toscanini, Furtwängler, I mean, they're great to look at, but it's very obvious that what they're doing is not for the audience, it is for the orchestra. And you get others like Pierre Monteux, the old French conductor, who was very restrained in his movement, but his eyes were everywhere, and you could read the score in his face. And conducting with too much thrashing about was genuinely believed to be a distraction from the music. Now, there's a big challenge because concert goers nowadays have to have the integrity to understand that music is mainly for the ears. But of course, we like to look as well. So now and again, I give them a little bit of show and panache, you see. Now and again.
And Christopher Seaman is the author of Inside Conducting, written with more than 40 years' experience as an orchestral conductor. Details are on the Bodysphere website. Christopher is also now Conductor Laureate for Life, fab title, of the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra in New York State. Speaking to us today, though, from Glasgow. Christopher, a great pleasure to get your insights. Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is The Bodysphere on RN with Amanda Smith. So now with orchestra conductors and with sign language interpreters, there are clearly gestures that are quite specific and precise ways of communicating without words. What about sign language we all use, though, often unconsciously, everyday body language? Now, there's a local council in the suburbs of Perth that's been reviewing its code of conduct and proposes to ban negative body language, things like rolling your eyes, shrugging your shoulders, deep sighing, pointing. David Keatley is a social and health psychologist at Curtin University in Perth. David, are these kinds of gestures so clear in their meaning that you could actually bar people from using them?
I don't think so. I think on the one hand, it might make people more aware, which I support, and I think that's a good thing, that we should be more aware of how we are coming across to other people. But I couldn't ever imagine a disciplinary case where someone's saying, "You shrugged at me at the wrong time." The difference between a shrug and just a slight tick or a shiver down the spine, how will you ever prove one way or another?
But anyway, more generally, the compelling idea of being able to read body language is that you can get to the truth of what someone is thinking but isn't saying. You know, for example, the idea that when you touch your face a lot, you're lying, or if I look up and to my right when I'm speaking to you, I'm apparently imagining, again, possibly lying. Are these reliable indicators? Are they giveaways to what's really going on?
They're really not. If they ever were, then I think the thing that people need to remember is that we're aware of these now. So if you're trying to lie to someone and it's very clear that if you touch your face it becomes a lie, then you'll automatically try and stop doing this. And that's one of the issues with whenever these body gestures or body language gets publicised, is this is the new tell for lying. People become aware of it and change their behaviour accordingly.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And a lot of this derives from NLP or neuro-linguistic programming, which was the idea that where the eyes look will give away what someone means, whether it's personal or emotional or lies or memories. And so far, those claims haven't been substantiated in laboratory testing. So when we put people into eye trackers, there's no real correlation between where people look and whether they're telling the truth or not. So I think the idea of looking at one particular gesture and saying that's the cue for lying or telling the truth is always going to be misguided. It's looking at clusters of body movements and changes in body gestures that really give some indication to what they're thinking underneath.
What is known, I think, is how people who are simpatico will often mirror each other's body postures and gestures. Is that right?
So this comes a lot from research looking at relationships and couples and how they interact with each other. And one of the things that two people very much in love will do is mimic each other's behaviours and postures.
So and this is presumably completely unconsciously.
For them, it's very much unconscious. It can be used for more deliberate or manipulative ways, but usually with couples, it becomes very much unconscious and automatic. So next time you're out at a coffee shop, if you look around for certain couples, you'll sometimes see them drinking coffee at the same time, which actually did happen yesterday. I was out for some drinks, and there was a couple of friends and some of my other friends trying to work out whether they were going out. And one of the things I picked up on with that was that the way they were sitting was very much a mirror image of each other. And when one of them took a drink of coffee, the other one would immediately at the same time. So there's this nice mirroring going on between them that was very automatic and natural between them, which leads me to believe that there is a certain case for them being a good couple together.
How handy are you?
Well, when they hear this, maybe not that handy, but I'll deny all knowledge that it's them.
And as you suggested, that mirroring can be a technique used to win friends and influence people.
Very much so. And things like car salesmen are the usual example that are given.
All right, use car salesmen.
Yeah, some car salesmen are taught to mirror the buyer, to try and make them feel as though you're their friend and you're on side with them.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the sale, you feel this mutual, as though you're both striving towards the same end because you've built up this rapport.
Yeah, classic sales technique, I suppose. As with all languages, spoken and sign languages, there's of course cultural specificity involved in body language, isn't there?
Yeah. There was an advert a few years ago by one of the world's leading banks who showed in quite a humorous way how different body language, different gestures around the world could be interpreted in different ways.
What did they do?
They had the OK sign where you touch your forefinger to your thumb. In some countries means OK, and in some countries is a rude insult or gesture, showing that it's the importance of knowing individual body language. And I think going back to the council, so one of the gestures they're interested in is a deep sigh they're trying to ban. I think that again is one of these issues where some countries, some cultures won't see deep sighing as any issue whatsoever, and I think you need to be very aware and careful that you're not actually negatively impacting on someone that wants to act in a normal way for them.
So you're saying that really that you have to read body language in context. It's not precise enough to say that this particular gesture or way of standing automatically means this particular thing.
Yeah, there's a difference between being physically tired on a Monday morning and, say, slouching slightly and actually being disinterested in something. So I think you need to take into account a lot more details. And remember that it's not an exact science. There's a lot of interpretation.
And David Keatley is from the Health Psychology and Behavioural Medicine Research Group at Curtin University in Perth. You can download or stream The Body Sphere, this and previous editions, at abc.net.au/radionational. From the list of programs there, choose The Body Sphere. I'm Amanda Smith.